Chapter 40, Wednesday, January 1st through Tuesday, January 7th, 1777. It is with much concern that I am to inform your lordship the unfortunate and untimely defeat at Trenton has thrown us further back than was at first apprehended from the great encouragement given to the rebels. British General William Howe, writing to Lord George Germain, Secretary of State for American Colonies after the American victory at Trenton. Just after the New Year came word of another shocking victory for the rebels, this one at Princeton in New Jersey. Washington's troops chased the British from the battlefield, killed a passel of them, and took a couple of hundred prisoners. Folks could scarce credit this, neither. Colonel Hawkins let out a roar in the study when the news was delivered and hit the unfortunate messenger on the head with a rolled-up map. Then he called for his horse and galloped off to headquarters. Within a day, the British promised boiled peas and rice with butter twice a week for their American prisoners, but they still did not allow fires in the Bridewell cells. The men had to eat their meat raw. Their chamber pots froze solid at night. The master's trip to London was moved up so that he could deliver news of the setbacks to the Parliament and King. Madam had finally accommodated herself to the notion of his voyage and had found a way to turn it to her advantage. Whilst we prepared Lockton's clothes for the journey, she wrote out long lists of items she wanted him to buy in England. I kept to the kitchen and cellar and woodpile when she was awake, but made my trips up island each day before dawn, looking over my shoulder at every sound, choosing a different path daily. The constant worry ate a hole in my belly. Corzine was stronger and told me not to fret, for he was not coughing up blood and his bowels were in fine working order, but he always asked me to come back on the morrow. The day of the master's departure, I roused myself extra early on account of I feared Madam might do the same. I deposited stale rolls and burnt hunks of pork on the windowsill of Corzine's cell, then crossed the commons on my way to the pump. There were a few folk out on their own early morning errands, all bundled in cloaks and blanket coats and shawls and scarves wrapped high. "You there!" a loud voice called out. Everyone stopped to look. "You there, girl!" Oh, no. A British soldier hurried toward me. I relaxed some when I saw his face. It was the mountain-sized guard who had let me visit Corzine's cell when he was first in prison, the one who liked to eat. "Haven't seen you round," he said as he neared me. I bobbed quickly. "The rules don't allow civilians in the cells." He lowered his rifle to the ground and eyed my bucket. "True enough. What you bring him today?" "Bread crust and burnt meat, sir." He wrinkled his nose. "What about yesterday?" "Yesterday was kidney pie and stale almond cake, sir." He shook his head and licked his lips. "Sorry I missed that, I am. Wouldn't hurt to drop off a bite now and then to one such as myself, would it?" "No, sir," I answered. "I shall remember that." He tilted his head to the side. "Your master ever hire you out?" "'Twas common in those days for folks to hire out their slaves to make money. The slaves did not see the money, of course. But if I had a chance to work away from the prying eyes of Madam, I'd be grateful for it." "Yes, sir," I lied. "We need a maid to clean out the cells. Dying men do puke out some terrible things, they do. You're a steadfast girl. Tell your mistress we pay her the going rate for your services."
"I shall tell her, sir."
He shouldered his rifle. "I'm on the night watch now. The name is Fisher. Bring me round some cake and I'll keep an eye on your brother."
"Thank you, Mr. Fisher, sir. I shall."
"No kidney pie, though. Kidney sour my gut. Something terrible." The master left for London with much muttering on the part of his wife. She did not take to her bed as I expected, but was driven round to the home of Mrs. Taylor to play cards and no doubt complain about her husband. While she was gone, Sarah birthed her baby boy in the cellar. I was so tempted to sneak down the stairs and watch. I'd seen kittens and calves come into the world, but not babies. I had a powerful curiosity about it, but I dared not. I kept water boiling for the midwife and stuck cloth in my ears to keep out the noise. When Sarah stopped hollering, I crept down the stairs to see the babe. He was a round-headed fat fellow with big eyes and bigger ears. "George," Sarah called him.
"You named him after the king?" Hannah asked.
"Perhaps," Sarah said cheerfully. "We've never figured the colonists would hold on this long. My man was saying the other night that maybe the king should stop the war. Maybe the babe and us might stay here, not sail home. Plenty of room here, he said. She kissed the baby's nose. A name like George is a good one on either side of the ocean.
Shh, warned Mary.
The next day, Sarah and her George moved to a house set aside for new mothers attached to the army. I was sad to see them go, for I had wanted to hold the little one and make him laugh.